I can fly a helicopter right in through the lobby and set it down inside the vault. And it would be a hell of a lot easier than breaking into the goddamn CIA.
Welcome to Franchise Fan Guys, where this is our second episode on the Mission Impossible franchise. I'm Tom Breifogel, joined with Skidmar and Andy Schmidt. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Andy?
Hey, I accepted this mission, and I'm already regretting it.
Hey, I'm Skid Marr, and the Secretary has disavowed any knowledge of this podcast. Franchise
Fan Guys. So Mission Impossible is based on a television series that predates it. It also has a rotating cast of directors and writers from the get-go. Does the fact that it's based on a TV series help it or hurt it? Does the film version do a good job of honoring the fans of the TV show? What do you think, Skid?
I'm actually a big fan of the TV show. I love the TV show. And I think there are some elements that they capture pretty well. It was, for its time, it had a few things going for it. The amazing theme song. That's an all-time classic theme song, which is used to great effect in the film franchise also, which is nice. And one thing about the TV show was that Bruce Geller, the creator, was adamant that there really not be any character development of the main crew, that the shows really be about the missions themselves, which is mostly true in this thing. I heard a story. Peter Graves, who played Jim Phelps in the original series, was telling a story that at the end of one of the episodes that he shot, they were walking away the person that they had defeated. They're walking him off in chains. And he just gave a little bit of a smile. And he said Bruce Geller called him up to his office and he said, "Don't editorialize." It was just like, just do the job and move on. And I was like, they don't take any pleasure in this. Like, they just do the job. That's it. And I was like, that's really cool. But the other thing is that the show had going for it was great acting, especially for the era. They had Martin Landau. They had Jim Graves. Graves was really good. Barbara Bain was awesome. Peter Lupus, Leonard Nimoy came in and replaced Martin Landau at one point. And I think they get really good performers in this too. I wanted to mention last time, one of the big strengths, I think one of the reasons for the improvement in the franchise was bringing in Simon Pegg in Mission Impossible 3. I love Simon Pegg. He's one of those guys from my generation. He was one of the first like geeks of my generation to really achieve prominence. And so that's always kind of heartwarming to see him succeed. But also, he's just such a good actor. Like, he just brings so much humor and skill to that. And that's really what the franchise needed, I thought. Yeah, I love the show. And I thought it really does a pretty good job of staying true to the spirit of that show while building on it quite a bit.
Tom, had you seen the show before?
I remember probably seeing clips of it when the first movie was coming out in 96. I bet I watched some MTV specials where they were like, this is based off a TV show, and I saw clips. But I don't remember the show. I remember seeing images of it or little clips of it. I don't remember a single episode in its entirety. I do have the gut feeling, and I could be wrong, is the first Mission Impossible movie much more like the show in the way it feels like a spy movie kind of?
Yeah, I mean, in as much as there is a Jim Phelps character, John Voight is playing him. Mm-hmm. But there's also something that's pretty different about the movies is that the main obstacle that the IMF team faces is their superiors in like every movie. And that's not true in the show.
The movies are kind of funny. One of the, and it's not really a complaint because it does work, but like it feels to me like Star Trek, where it's like, if you blow up the Enterprise every movie, I really don't care when you blow up the Enterprise. Like, if they're disavowed and the IMF is destroyed and turned against them every movie, that stops being a big deal, right? And one of the things about the Mission Impossible movies is, like, even when they're not disavowed, like, they're on their own. Like, it's not like the IMF shows up and helps them ever. So, like, when you're there on their own, how is that really all that different? Because anytime they're on their own, they're like, here, you're going to be on your own, but let me give you all this really cool stuff. Like, and I'll tell you where to go and who to hit and, like, all this stuff. You know, like, like, I don't ever really get the sense that they're really on their own, right? Because, like, even in even when the secretary is blown up in front of Ethan Hunt and IMF is completely dissolved, the last thing he does is give him, like, a train car full of super cool stuff.
Right.
That he can use to beat the bad guy, you know. Anyway, sorry, I digress. Red light!
Green light! Did the show have more things like the exploding bubblegum, like more over-the-top Batman-esque belt weapons?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a lot of gadgetry in the show.
Yeah.
There was the guy, the character Barney was kind of their gadget guy. And he was like they all had day jobs too, or they all like came from day jobs, all the agents. And his day job was he was kind of like his Tony Stark character. He was like this pioneering inventor, electrician guy, electrical engineer. So yeah, that was definitely like always a big part of it. And disguises were always a huge appearances, and that kind of subverting appearances is a huge part of it too. Like that's the probably the biggest key element that carries over.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I'm sure I saw several episodes when I was like really a kid, like, you know, under 10, because I'm sure my, you know, reruns were going at that time when reruns were a thing. And, so I'm sure I saw it, you know, in the same way that I saw episodes of Magnum PI here and there, because my mom liked that show. But I was never into it, and I certainly was never like really like analyzing what the show was. So for me, going into the first Mission Impossible, yeah, I knew it was based on a show, but like I had no connection to that show. And I remember like vaguely thinking, "Oh, Jim Phelps, pretty sure that character is from the show," but I couldn't even have told you that was Peter Graves' character or that it was the main character of the show. And so it was actually well into the movie franchise when I was having a conversation. Actually, it was like around 4 or 5 when those were coming out. And I was like, and I remember I was talking with somebody at a comic convention about how impressed I am with how much better this franchise seems to keep getting and how like surprising and shocking that is. And that person was a huge fan of the show, and she hates the movies because the first movie like made Jim Phelps the villain, and she felt she felt so betrayed.
Sure.
That is definitely something that they have been struggling to kind of overcome since then, you know. I mean, and there's, I don't know that there's a whole lot you can do about that, because you pretty clearly made Jim Phelps the bad guy, and like a pretty bad guy, like not really a redeemable one.
No, like a bad guy. He's bad.
Right. Yeah.
He's not just misunderstood. He's bad.
Right. Yeah. Not sympathetic, really. But yeah, so like that was all kind of news to me. And then I kind of went back and did, you know, and did a little bit more research. I always saw the gum as, you know, again, I didn't know that much about the TV series. So like, I didn't know that there was a lot of gadgetry. I knew there were the masks. Like I knew they pretended to be other people all the time, but I didn't know about the gadgets. So I saw the gum in Mission Impossible 1 as them sort of trying to go like, this is going to be an American version of James Bond. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, kind of may have been some of the inspiration for the original show. I don't know. But you know, and it seemed to me like that gum thing didn't, I mean, it worked. Like, it's not like something that takes me totally out of the movie, but like, it also wasn't something that like, I wanted to see more stuff like that. And they don't really do a lot of stuff like that anymore. That's that gimmicky. There's cool equipment, and there's cool tech, there's stuff like that that's not real, but not this sort of gimmicky, like my belt buckle turns into a giant magnet type stuff.
Yeah, that's very James Bond.
Yeah, they pulled back from that after the first one. The other thing that's interesting is that Ethan Hunt doesn't use a gun really in the first one. He holds a gun at one point, but I don't think he fires a single shot in that movie. And then you go from that to Mission Impossible 2, where he probably shoots about 30,000 rounds of bullets. And then he uses guns throughout. But one of the things that I remember at the time really liking about Mission Impossible was that moment where it's, you know, zero body count, which makes perfect sense in that scene because they're breaking into Langley. They're bringing into a CIA headquarters. So presumably those are all good guys in there. You don't want to kill any of them. But I really like that as an idea that they are, they're very surgical, right? They're not the guys that go in and just bomb the crap out of a city. They're the guys that go in, they get the job done, they get out, and you don't even know they were ever there. And I think that's a really cool thing for an action franchise. And they get away from that. I mean, they get away from it to a certain extent. Like, there's definitely body counts, but they don't tend to be, you know, over the top body counts in the subsequent movies. But that was an aspect of the first one that I really liked that didn't carry through tremendously. But I thought that was cool because it just makes their job harder. And when their job is harder, it's more entertaining for us. You know?
Yeah. Totally. I think that for me too, like that's the most thrilling moments of the franchise, even more than the crazy stunts, is those moments of guile and cleverness and trickery. Like the one, the Wolf Blitzer scene in
Five. I love that scene.
Oh my God, that's so great.
Six, yeah. That's six, in Fallout. Yeah. Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah. And six, and later on, when Henry Cavill ends up revealing himself and you don't realize that it's when he all of a sudden is just like, oh wait, I'm not talking to Lane, I'm talking to a guy in a mask and he rips the mask open. I was like, oh, I forgot that masks were a thing in this movie. I completely forgot. I was like, oh, whoa, that's Simon Pegg. It was great. I started like just laughing my ass off. This is amazing.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I think they learned, we talked about this a little bit in episode one, why they learned not to overuse the masks. Because if you're constantly being reminded there are masks, it's never a surprise.
Yes. And it's funny, too. They were sort of influenced by James Bond's when it came out, but it was more a direct sort of directly inspired by these like French heist movies. They took these like criminals that were pulling these like elaborate bank heists and they made them the good guys. That was the main kind of concept.
Like Sneakers, another great movie.
Great movie. Franchise fan
guys. That's interesting that's kind of where that's where the initial influences came from. One of the things that you said, Skid, about Bruce Geller was that he didn't want any character development. And I think there's character development in these Mission Impossible movies. Not a ton, but yeah. there are like arcs and things. And
yeah.
I think it's harder to maintain, you know, 2 full hours of big stuff happening if you are not getting emotionally invested in the characters.
Sure.
You know, and procedural, like there are several genres that are like procedural genres and sort of, you know, spy movies can fit that role. And if you're not, you know, they can take you for a while. But yeah, I think after an hour or so, if I'm not caring on some level about the stakes or about, you know, what's going on in this character's head. But that's one of the reasons why I think Fallout is the best one, is because that's really the only one where I feel like Ethan Hunt has stuff, like has his, like who he is on the line in that movie. Like the first one, he's essentially betrayed by like his mentor, seemingly, right? Like, and his whole team is killed. Like there's a lot of emotional stakes for him. Like there's a good reason why he's amped up and all that in that one, right? And in Mission Impossible 3, you know, he's married and she winds up in danger. And like, I get the emotional stakes in that. But like, Fallout is different because Fallout is like deeply about who he is. And he's forced to constantly be making decisions that if he makes one decision, bad things are probably going to happen, but he hasn't betrayed who he is. And if he allows something bad to happen in the moment, it'll probably be better for the greater good, but he can't do it. But he's constantly being put in these positions in Fallout where, like, if he makes the wrong move, he stops being Ethan Hunt and he stops being the hero. And that is the movie that makes that, where I came out of that one like really concretely going, he's not a hero by circumstance anymore. He is a hero because that is who he is.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, to me, that was a really defining thing. And I don't know that a lot of moviegoers are going to look at it that way, but you probably feel that because it really, really is. There are a lot of scenes like, you know, we were talking about the stunts and like the cool tricks and things in Fallout, but my actual favorite scene in Fallout is one of the smallest, but it's when they've got Lark and they've got him like tied up and they've got Lane, him tied up and they're just moving in the garage to put him in a car and the garage door opens and there's that French police woman.
Yeah.
Just like writing a parking ticket and she's just there. And
they're all just standing frozen for like 10 seconds. Like no one knows what to do.
Yeah. And he's in this position, right? Like, is he going to shoot her? Like he can't shoot her. Right. You know, I mean, it's great. And then when the other bad guys show up and they shoot her and she's injured and now he's got four bad guys over there and he's got an innocent policewoman that's bleeding, potentially bleeding out, and he's got Lane behind him. Like there are you know, what he does from there is speaks entirely to who he is as a character. And I think that's maybe the best scene in that whole movie. I actually get excited leading up to, because I've seen the movie a couple times now, right? I actually get excited leading up to that scene. And it's not a big stunt scene. You know, it's not a big set piece.
It's just
scene.
Little, it's great. A phenomenal scene. There's so much tension, that real conundrum there. Like, what does he do? I love it. I love that scene.
Yeah. So kind of getting back to the core of that question, like, I don't know that they do. I have not seen enough of the episodes to know if they do a good job of sort of honoring the show. I would say probably if you ask really big fans of the show, my guess is that they would say no. But I wonder how many of the people that really were, you know, the fans of the show that really hated that first one, I wonder if any of them have, or how many of them, I'm sure some have sort of been converted since then. And you know, sometimes as a fan, you just sort of have to divorce things. You just sort of have to be like, it's sort of Mission Impossible, and now I can like it.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like at this point, they've been making Mission Impossible movies. When the new one comes out, 26 years, 25 years. The TV show, I'm just guessing, it wasn't on TV nearly that long, right?
No. There was a second iteration that came out in 1988 and ran for two seasons.
Right.
Which was actually, that was interesting because there was a huge writer's strike in 1988, which really affected my life a lot as a child. But they had no new script. So what they did is they remade Mission Impossible because they had these old, like a lot of unused scripts, and they just shot those.
Oh, wow.
And Peter Graves and those guys actually came back for that, right?
Yeah, Peter Graves, I think was the one returning cast member, yeah.
So, Skid, since you like the TV show, do you feel like the film version establishes itself on its own?
Yeah, oh yeah. The movies have their own identity. Yeah, I was thinking, like, I don't think that, like, the really hardcore TV Mission Impossible fans were the core target audience for this film franchise, and that's fine. This is a new thing. It's a hook to get people to buy the ticket for the first time and then just do your own kind of heist movie. But yeah, I mean, I think mostly the mark that these movies leave that is their own is the action, because they're just, there were fight scenes and stuff in the original show, but nothing like the crazy stunts that you see in these. And also, the thing that was cool about the show was they would travel to a bunch of kind of exotic locales, a lot of like Eastern Europe, like behind the Iron Curtain and everything. But they shot everything in Pasadena. So it just everything, nothing really looked right. Whereas in this, they actually go to these exotic locations, which is kind of sets it apart in that way too. They're actually, honestly, like well, a lot of the DNA from the TV show is in the film franchise. They feel really different. And I love them both for different reasons.
Well, I think, too, the part of it is your budget is obviously so much bigger on this. So, like, the film franchise in some ways does some of the things. I think this is kind of what you were getting at, right? Is it, like, the films actually do some of the things the shows wanted to do, but just, like, didn't have the budget to do. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, like, so they would have loved to have gone to Kashmir for the show, but, like, not in the budget.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the other thing too, and we talked about how much they kind of learn from you know, they clearly pay attention to what's working and what's not for fans. And I think after that first one, it was just so clear that the scene, the thing in that first one was going into Langley. That became that was so iconic, right? When he's dangling from the wires in the computer room thing, that they were like, okay, we need to, there's going to be a heist, right? In all of these things, like, and that heist aspect grew out of what they did in the first Mission Impossible. Mm-hmm. It's interesting too, because I think the masks in Mission Impossible 1 don't work at all. They're terrible. Like, him pretending to be the senator or whatever it is, like, it just, like,
oh, I know, it's just
awful.
Well, that's actually such a throwback to the show, because Martin Landau would end up impersonating all these generals and politicians that just miraculously happened to look a lot like Martin Landau in makeup. So that was it's like, that's clearly Tom Cruise just wearing the old age makeup. But yeah,
right, yeah, it is interesting to see how the film franchise sort of figured out what it was. Like, it's that first one is clearly from that show, but then it starts figuring out that it's not the show. It's a different medium. It's a different scale. It's different actors. It's all that stuff. And it figures out how to play to its own strengths as a film franchise from there. Sorry, Tom. I think I cut you off.
Oh, no. Mine was just, I never thought about this as a kid. I don't know if either of you guys have an answer. At the CIA headquarters in Langley, why wouldn't they just have a camera or a motion detector instead of the floor or the heat detection or the decibel reader?
Ed, you should work for the CIA, Tom. God, that's the kind of outside-the-box thinking that just isn't reflected in these movies.
I mean, in 1996, my grandparents had motion detectors on their when they left the house, their home security system. So that heist wouldn't have worked there.
I think what you didn't know is that your grandparents were actually keepers of the knock list. So
okay.
Got to keep it safe, man.
Keep it secret. Keep it safe. That's a great question. And I have questions like that all the time in these movies of like, well, wait a second. Why isn't there just this? But yeah, but it's funny too. Like, one of the things that I always think is funny is like how easy it is in movies to like disable cameras. Yeah. And once this is one of the things that's sort of true of like franchises like this. Like, once you disable a camera once in like a Mission Impossible movie, it's not interesting to disable it in the next movie. Like, you just have to go right past it. So, like, was it Mission Impossible 3 when they're going into the Vatican? Like, they have this sort of elaborate setup where there's the photograph, and then they put the little harness on the camera, and they print out the photograph, and they put it in front of the camera so the camera only sees the photograph, but it thinks it's seeing the thing. Like, there's this sort of, like, elaborate thing that they do to trick the cameras, right? And then by, like, I think it's, like, 4 or 5, like, you know, they'll like parachute in, and just with a pistol they'll shoot at a camera and it puts a little disc on it, and you're like, well, that camera doesn't work anymore, or somehow that tricks the camera into whatever. But they just don't want to deal with it because they've already shown that they can do it, so it's not interesting to see them do that type of thing again. It is funny though, you're referencing the first one where they had not disabled a camera that I recall at that point. But good question, Tom. And should you meet Tom Cruise, I think you should ask him.
Yeah.
Or Brian De Palma. From one Tom to another.
But you know what? I bet he will answer your question thoughtfully and politely. Everybody that I've talked to that has met Tom Cruise has said that regardless of how insane he is, neurotic he is, he always treats everyone from the lowliest question giver to the highest priest or potentate with the utmost respect.
How many priests and potentates are asking him questions about Mission Impossible?
All the time. Well, they break into the Vatican. They're like, well, why'd you break into the Vatican? What's up with that?
They're very concerned about that. Yeah, like, I know. Think that breaking into the Vatican is sending the right message, Tom.
Right. It's like, why you got to be doing that, Tommy?
Hasta lasagna, don't get any on you.
It sounds like we kind of agree that like it does come from the show. It has the DNA of the show. And then would we agree that it does sort of find its own footing as a film franchise and mutates accordingly because of the difference of the medium and scale? Does that track for you guys, or am I just barking up the wrong tree?
Yeah, no. Although one thing I will say, because you mentioned the character development thing, I wanted to say that, yeah, Ethan does absolutely, like, he's the protagonist of the film. Like, he gets his own character development. And the more he gets, like, the stronger the series gets. I think you're right. But everyone else on the team, really the only character development that they get stems completely from the missions themselves. Like, I don't know, we get like a blurb, a sentence or two maybe about Luther's life outside of IMF. We don't know anything about Benji's life outside of IMF. We know that he plays Halo at work when nobody's watching. And we get like, oh, he was at Oxford. And like, that's basically it. So there is some character development, but it all centers on the mission and the agency.
Yeah, which we're going to talk about next episode. We're going to talk about these missions.
Nice.
Thanks for listening to Franchise Fan Guys, Mission Impossible episode 2 of 5. Please write a review and give a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Intro music by Tom Breifogel and John Harvey. To connect, visit franchisefanguys.com, at franchisefanguys on Instagram, and at guysfranchise on Twitter.
Be seeing you.
I'll be back.